Daryl Mookie Mitchell joins us. Mookie, how you doing?
I'm good, buddy. What's going on?
You know what? Just trying to get by like everybody else at this point. So before we get going, who gave you the nickname Mookie?
College roommate. My college roommate gave me that name when I first got to Texas Tech. We was sitting in the living room just watching a little basketball. We was watching a basketball game, and he just looked over at me on the other end of the couch and just said, "Hey, man, you look like a guy who should have a nickname Mookie, right?" And so I just thought it was just like, I thought it was just going to stay right there in our apartment, right? And so, the next day we go to practice, and he just started calling me Mookie. So coaches and teammates are looking at me like, "Who is Mookie?" You know? And so it just stuck. So coaches, teammates just started calling me Mookie at Tech, right? And it just stuck throughout my career. So
Mookie, you talked about your time at Texas Tech, but you actually started at junior college. You know, how did you end up at the junior college prior to heading off to Texas Tech?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was one of those stories that I tell the kids all the time that I work with, right? And I'm telling them about just sometimes you let that ego get in the way. And it was, never struggled with academics in school, right? And I ended up doing the SAT, and it was all on me. I was supposed to have been headed to Florida, University of Florida, from high school. Like, the recruit was coming every week, coming to all the games. And I would just study, like, lying to the guy, like, "Oh, yeah, I signed up to take it," right, the SAT, right? Because I thought, it's just another exam. Never struggled, like I said, with academics in school, right? But then I find out after the fact, I waited, just typical, just wanted to be this little brainiac thinking I know everything. So I waited till the last time you could take the SAT. And when I got home, and, I was just telling my brother, like, man, that shit was tougher than I thought it was, right? And I found out by answering questions that I didn't know counted against you. And when I just remember getting the results in the mail and came up, like, a point short. And it just, like, pissed off University of Florida. So they was like, "No," because he told us that he was going to sign. He signed up for it, like, long time ago. And that's how I ended up going to JUCO. Right. And so the only person I had on my side at that time was my mom. My family, they was just beating me up, calling me idiots. She's like, "What are you doing?" Because it was either Florida, and then the second pick would have been like Penn State. So I knew I was supposed to be going to D1 right out of high school. And so I ended up going to Joliet, like right outside of Chicago. And the good part about that, I ended up going with like three more other teammates from high school. So that kind of made those 2 years go by, like, real fast at the JUCO, right? So,
Daryl Mookie Mitchell joins us. You were also, I think, the league's co-player of the year. So going there and getting to dominate, did it make you a better player?
Yeah, I mean, it did. It really did because I've always been the type of player or person that I was always humble, but that experience really, like, humbled me. Because now I have to now get up and go, like, thousands of miles across the U.S. to, like, an unknown, like, city and state that I'd never been in as a 17-year-old, right? And so I ended up – the funny thing about it was I ended up going with the junior college coach to Knoxville College. I took the bus, so he wanted me to wait because I had to wait to get, like, a grade change from a professor. But the only one that could have overrided that was the dean of the school. And so he was like, he wanted to wait. He didn't want to do it. So I ended up going to Knoxville College. So Texas Tech, when I got there to Knoxville College, the night that the bus arrived. So I'm taking a bus from Joliet, Illinois to Knoxville, Tennessee. And half of the team had done already left with the coach and the and his wife. And so when I got there that night, I'm having dinner with the head coach at his house. And I'm just like, I done came up short again. And so Texas Tech ended up calling and saying that we'll take him. We wanted him that bad. We'll just let him redshirt. So lo and behold, that next morning, I'm on a bus again from Knoxville, Tennessee to Lubbock, Texas. And from there, the rest was history. Like, I went there, ended up getting drafted to the Saints in the sixth round of 94, and then played there the 2 years. And then after that, came up here to Canada because I was just tired of going with the back and forth with the politics of the NFL. And so I came, you know, to Toronto in 97. And my agent, he was shocked that I said that I'll go play arena or CFL, right? You know, because I've always watched it, but I knew nobody that currently had that played in the CFL. And so when I came, it was just like Pinball, Mazzotti, Doug Flutie, all those guys just took me under their wings right after I made the team. So
Daryl Mookie Mitchell joins us, longtime CFL wide receiver. You know, in between there, you skipped over your time in the World League. What was that like playing for the Scottish Claymores of the World League of American Football?
Oh, that was actually more fun. That football was more fun than college football, right? Because you got guys that have been in the league like a year or two. You're there with like buddies that you know that's playing with other teams that was allocated over there, like myself. And you're just going all over Europe, you know. Like, this is what I'm saying. Like, I'm experiencing this as a guy that's under 20. I'm just all over Europe, and you're just playing football. You're practicing once a day, and you're getting to travel Barcelona, you know, Dusseldorf, Amsterdam. It was fun.
Now, Daryl, you when you broke into the CFL, you come in 1997, and you had 160 catches, man. That's a league record. I don't think it's ever going to be broken. You're averaging 10 catches per game because back then it was only a 16-game season.
Yes. And so, the funny thing about, like, that year and only those it was just only, like, just the ex-wife and my son, that the ones that knew the truth other than the people that I told, because that was going into my second year. So I had we just won the Grey Cup. And so, you know, the whole off season was just spent just celebrating, you know, just celebrating with friends and family, right? And so I had them been celebrating so much and just being a couch potato that the season came up on me. And I just remember, like, the week going into training camp, I just went to the park that was close to my house, and I just ran, like, 100-yard strider because I'm going into training camp, like, haven't even picked up a football, haven't even caught a football. So I just went to the park running just a couple of 100-yard striders all that week. And then I got into training camp. So for the fact that I knew the offense, I knew, and I got the same coordinator and whatever, which was Coach Jenkins, it would just be just make it through training camp and I'll get myself into shape as the season went along, right? And so the funny part that I have with that, and I just tell a lot of athletes that I talk to today, please don't try that, because I had God on my side that year that I was able to have 160 catches and didn't work out none that offseason. But every practice since the first day of training camp, Coach Jenkins would put me with the quarterback, and he just had me just doing all kind of different screens and shovel passes and all that, because he already had this idea in his mind, and I guess I was the perfect receiver for his thought process that he wanted to accomplish that year. And the catches just started just accumulating each game. And so me and him, we didn't know where it stopped. But I would say this, the one thing, when I saw him a couple of years ago at our reunion, the thing that hurt him that year is that, you know, Coach Jenkins, anybody that knows Coach Jenkins know he's a guy that's built on stats. And that year I had the 160 with the even 2,000. Yep. And the Toronto season record for reception was Terry Greer, and he had 2,003 yards. And when Coach Jenkins found that out after I broke the record in Montreal, he wished he would have just gave me a 5-yard hitch pass. He was so pissed that he didn't let me. But I'm like, Coach, I done caught like 160. Like, we didn't even know where it was going to stop. But he wanted me to just smash like all the records, right? So,
did you know going in that Terry Greer had 2,003 yards?
No, I didn't know. I didn't know. The only time I knew, like I said, like once the season was going on and once I got to like that 120 mark, that's when all the reporters in Toronto was coming up to me and they was like, do you know where you – nobody knew what was going to be the final numbers because it was probably like week 10 and I'm at 120. So everybody like, where is this number going to stop? And then that's when the number started coming up about the 2003. But I paid the 2,000 yards. I wasn't more concerned about like the yards because I didn't think I was going to get 2,000 yards. And I was just everybody knew that one, the record was going to be broken. Right. So I guess it was more focused on the catches than the actual yards that year.
Daryl Mookie Mitchell joins us. Mook, I want to get you to stick with us through a break because I want to go back more to your childhood and your family and your mom because you got a very unique story about that too when we return.
Okay.
Perfect. We'll get more with Daryl Mookie Mitchell next on Edmonton Sports Leader TSN 1260. You're listening to the Jason Greger Show. 527, Jason Greger, Jason Strada, Connor Halley with you as we continue on Edmonton Sports Leader TSN 1260. As we continue on, story time with Daryl Mookie Mitchell, two-time Grey Cup champion, of course, holds a CFL record for most catches in a season with 160. He's retired, married with two kids, living in Edmonton. As it continues on, now Mook, I want to get back to your childhood. Like I know you have a big family. How many siblings you got? How many kids in your family?
I'm the youngest of 11.
Okay, that's what I thought. I thought you were the youngest. So, mom was supporting you. So, were you mama's favorite growing up your entire life?
Oh, I was the favorite. I dodged all the licks. I dodged it all. I dodged it all. I was the biggest suck up out of the 11. Yeah, if I did something wrong, I was meeting mama at the corner, like grabbing all her purse and the bags. So I told mama what happened before she made it to the house. Like, yeah, you might need a belt when you get home, mama. You know? So my brothers and sisters hated me growing up because I got away with murder.
Now, how much did that, affect having so many older siblings? How did that affect, like, your athletic ability or slash performance?
It was huge for us because all of my brothers, well, I came from an athletic background, like brothers, sisters, they all played high school sports. And my brother, he even made it off to the collegiate level, but he didn't pursue it. So we all, as a family, shoot, just with 11 of us, we could do so many pickup games just within the one household, right? So we would go out and we would just, like, even the sisters, we would play football in the streets, basketball in the streets, or we would just go to the park, play softball, or do just like the little average track and field, like on the streets, just racing against each other. So it was a lot of competition within the household, but it's like my older brother, he kind of took me under his wings because I guess he just saw, I guess, you know, some people can just see like that special talent that an individual may have. And my oldest brother, I never will forget when I'm like 7, 8 years old, he's taking me to the park to play with him and his friends, which are like 18, 20 year olds. And I mean, these guys were playing sandlot football and they're knocking each other's teeth out. And I mean, they didn't even take it light on me with being the youngest out there. So one of the ways that my brother made the game of football so easy for me with the mental and physical toughness is that he forced me to, you know, just get in there and catch passes and get hit or, you know, run the ball out of the backfield and get tackled by like these 18, 20 year olds. So when I made it to high school and I started playing organized football, the only thing I had to get adjusted to was now playing with like these pads and this helmet on. But as of the mental and physical toughness, it was already there, right? So
you never played organized football until high school. You just played sandlot with your brother and his friends.
Yeah, I would just play sandlot football. We would just go play against, like, other friends, you know, in their neighborhoods, like, during the summer or, like, during the spring. But I didn't play, like, none of the Little League football. I always went and watched it, but I just said I wanted to wait to play football once I made it to high school. Didn't play it in junior high. I just loved playing, like, sandlot and just watching, like, the Little League guys, the younger guys play in their league. So once I made it to high school, that was my first time playing organized football.
Did you play in other organized sports, or was it all just kind of with your buddies?
Yeah, and that was just it. Like I said, then I ran, like, for the park that was in the neighborhood. I ran track. I did track and field. Okay. And so other than that, it was just always football and track for me.
Daryl Mookie Mitchell joins us. Now, you grew up in Miami, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so football there obviously was a big deal, right? The University of the Hurricanes in Miami. You had the Dolphins, but everybody there wanted to be a Hurricane. I don't think there's any question about the Florida State. So it was really a football area. Being the youngest of 11 kids was one of the main reasons you didn't play, just because your family didn't have the money to put you in organized sports?
Well, yeah, that was one of the reasons, because my mom was a single parent, and she couldn't afford, like, those fees for, like, to sign up for, like, the Little League sports. So I didn't put that pressure on her, and I knew she couldn't afford it. And because when you would go and you just listen to your buddies who did play, and you just see, like, how much the fees was worth, I mean, it's nothing in this day and age, but a single parent raising 11 kids, you know, I didn't even put that pressure on my mom. So I just say, I'll just wait till I get to high school to where you don't have to pay nothing, right? So,
Mookie, when you did get to high school, were people like, where the hell did this guy come from? Like, were you did you have that much impact on your team?
Yeah, like me and my brother that's a year older than me, he was he also played on the same football team as well, right? So one of the things that helped me out a lot was I had the ability to run. And so any coach that got a guy that is fast, he's going to find a position for you. And so with my size alone, like, I'm not playing nothing on defense. So normally if you're fast, they're going to put you at either running back or receiver, right? And so the coach just told me to line up at receiver. And, you know, I played Sandlot football, so I knew the dynamics of running routes. Mm-hmm. So then I just had to, like I say, my only adjustment in high school was just learning now to run with this gear on, right? And then over the years, once I liked college and then the pros, that's when I became, you know, you just started to learn the game and just become a student of the game and make the game a whole lot easier for yourself. So,
you know, you're a fast guy. Why ultimately did you end up at wide receiver? Is that, you know, was your body type more built for that? Or, like, because I'm always interested how, because football seems to me like there's different body types and different abilities for everyone. But if there's speed in both places, why did you end up there rather at running back?
Yeah, well, for one reason, I didn't want to play running back. I didn't have time to be blocking, no, catching up like Ray Lewis coming up the A-gap. No, I'm not blocking no 250-pound linebacker. So my brother played that position, and I'm like, hey, man, you can have that. And that, to be honest with you, I didn't want no part of that. I'm telling you, so people today still say, like, you know, you receivers, y'all run across the middle, and y'all just get laid out. But at least we can see the guy. You know, we can see the defender. And the good thing that I've always, anything with any stat that I ever broke, I always praise my quarterbacks, because I've always had good quarterbacks that didn't lead me into, like, coverage.
Right.
And then, like I said, with me being a student of the game, if I was playing with a younger quarterback, like I did a lot in those Toronto years, I'm going to stop. I'm not going to run into a headache. I'm going to stop so that my quarterback better see what I see. You know,
right? Yeah.
So, being around, like, starting the lead off, coming into the CFL, and I'm playing with a guy of Doug Flutie's caliber. Doug, like I tell people today, I'll suit up and play with him today if he wanted to play. Because that 97 year to me was my easiest year of football. It took me back to just like growing up in Miami playing Sandlot, because Doug just, he found a mismatch during the week when he would watch film, and he would just put me, Pinball, Robert Drummond, he would put us in a position to win. He would create that mismatch where sometimes he would even line me up in the backfield where I got like a middle linebacker covering me. And now he's swinging me out the back. So, like I said, it was fun football in 97. It was fun, and it was just, you know, you're around a coach like Coach Matthews, who was already, like, arrogant, and he just loved winning, right? And so it was just a whole shock for me in 97, because they just came off of that big win, the Grey Cup win in 96. You bring 95% of the team back, and from day one of training camp, these guys are talking about repeat, and they was already saying, and it's no disrespect to none of the other teams, but the guys on the team at that time was feeling that we were going to face Edmonton in the Grey Cup because of what the 96 Grey Cup.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I knew for sure We knew all year long from every game, from week one, we was going to meet Edmonton in the Grey Cup. We thought it was going to be Edmonton.
Yeah, so did Eskimo fans, and then it didn't happen, Mook. It didn't happen.
Yeah,
but
it was a shock. It was a shock to us because I would never forget. We played earlier, and we all left the game, and we shot to Pinball's house, and we watched the game against Edmonton and Saskatchewan, and our jaws was on the ground when Saskatchewan came in here and won, and so we like, wow, we're playing Saskatchewan.
And you spanked him pretty good in 97. That wasn't really very close at all. Daryl Mookie Mitchell joins us. Now, Daryl, the interesting thing, you know, I got to know you, of course, when you were with the Eskimos for a few seasons. And that receiving core, when you look at great receiving cores in the history of the CFL, that receiving core, you know, yourself, and you had Hervey, and you had Terry Vaughn, you had Tucker, like, man, yeah. Rick Walters, like, there was a lot of really good receiving cores. It's interesting, though, because a lot of receivers had, you had to be a little selfish at times. You know, you want to want the ball. You never seemed to have any of that, at least outwardly. And compared to a lot of those other guys, like Ed Hervey was really vocal guy, you know, pretty physical and aggressive. And Terry Vaughn, there was like grease dropping off his hair all the time. Like he was just, he's very cocky and arrogant and not a bad way, but just that's how he was. How come you never had any of that? Or did you? And it just, we never saw it.
No, it wasn't me. And like I said earlier, like I've always just been that humble player, and I just feel like it's not my job as a player to walk up in my coach face and bark at like the offensive coordinator or the head coach to throw me the ball. Because I just always feel as an athlete, if you're a part of this game plan, they're going to figure out a way to get you the ball. And I just remember just coming here in 04, everybody that was just the buzz. Like, you got four all-stars at receiver. But I guess one of the things that complimented us so well, the four receivers from 04, like you said, Ed was more vocal. Terry Vaughn wanted it. And me and Tucker were just going to sit back and wait till the ball come our way, and we're going to make a play. And so whoever was the hot hand that week or that game, everybody, we just rolled with it. If it was Tucker's week, it was your week. If it was my week, it was my week. If it was Ed, we just rolled with it, right? And I think that's why we were so successful here, my 3 years here, because we wasn't a selfish group. And now if any of the guys ever did it, I never heard it myself on game day or in practice. But I do know there has been a lot of times that even during some games, like I would hear Ed go up to the quarterbacks like Ricky and Jay Moss and tell them like, hey, man, you need to throw Mook the ball or you need to throw Tuck the ball because they got a mismatch, right? Because we all were just about trying to figure out that way to win. And I just would never forget the 05 Grey Cup where me and Ricky couldn't connect on the corner route and all throughout the playoff, like the tail end of the season. And then when we went down to Calgary, me and Ricky just couldn't connect. But I just remember that whole week of preparation when we was practicing in BC Place, and it was all five of us standing there, me, Ricky, Tucker, Jay Moss, and Ed Hervey. And Ed Hervey told Ricky, he said, if we're going to win this game, you and Mookie got to find y'all magic. You guys got to find the magic. So that whole week, I just kept, every time I ran the corner route, I just went high. You know, because during Calgary, I just kept trying to – I was second-guessing myself because I'm trying to, you know, just beat the DB so bad. And Ricky was throwing high when I was going low. And then finally, that whole week of preparation during that week of Grey Cup, I just went high. And then it ended up being one of the game-winning catches that won us the Grey Cup, right? So
– yeah.
Yeah, so Ed today, you know, he's one of the little geniuses because he said in order for us to win this game, Mookie and Ricky, you got to find your magic again, right? Because Tucker and Ricky had it, but I guess it was just something that Ed knew we had to have another X factor going into that game, right?
Mookie Mitchell joins us, and you know what? Yeah, great teammates of the guys who know, hey, we got some other good guys. We got to get them involved to help us win. Mm-hmm. Mook, I want to take one final break because I need you to stick around because I want to talk about the job you're doing now with kids in Edmonton. I think it's hugely important. I want to discuss that when we return. More with Daryl Mookie Mitchell on Storytime on Edmonton Sports Leader TSN 1260. A famer. Daryl Mookie Mitchell. And Daryl, you live in Edmonton, of course. Here full time with your two children, but you got a very important job. Update our listeners on what you're doing now in retirement.
Oh, well, right now I'm just a team leader here at a youth facility here, a group home here on the south side. And I've been doing this, the team leader job since 2013. And I mean, it's a good experience for me. You know, when I go out and I'm enrolling these kids in school, I'm just always hearing like daily or yearly, like, you know, so many people just congratulate myself and my staff on what we do, because most people say they couldn't do this job because they know, like, you know, when you're dealing with kids in care, it could be a handful. But one of the things that I've always, you know, when I'm talking with these principals and the teachers, is that the one thing I do that makes these kids' life easy is that I'm always been a real patient person. And then just coming from like a big family, because I work with eight Indigenous youth, right? And a lot of these kids, they had a rough ride, and a lot of them don't understand why they are in care, because some of them was too young to remember, you know. So one of the things that I do is just try to always just, you know, just keep these kids calm and just, you know, just try to keep them safe. And I'm always advocating for them, right, whenever they're having a bad day at school. So I've always, what I've done since I've been the team leader, is always made it to where if these kids having a bad day, schools, teachers, principal, they call me and I remove them from the school. And the next day is a new day, right? And so, like I say, I love working with these kids because they're younger kids and they keep me young. So
there's no doubt. You must be a pretty patient guy, because you're right. There's going to be ups and downs all the time, especially mm-hmm. you, especially at risk kids. What do you bring from your sporting background that helps you have that perspective?
Well, it's like you said, it's a team perspective. You come with some guys and you always hear some guys are great guys. Then you'll hear some guys are like the cancers of the locker room. Right. And just with the many teams that I played with over my 11-year career, you're going to always witness that each team every year is different. You're going to have these guys that would rather try to go out partying like the night before the game. And then on game day, when we need you, you don't show up, right? Because you're still like feeling like what you did the night before. So it's those learning lessons that I just learned from just the game of football and just the years of just growing through that struggle in Miami, being the youngest of 11. You just learn to be patient, and you just learn to just always keep a cool head, because the more, if I'm calm, it keeps those kids that I'm dealing with, it keeps those kids calm. You know, because a lot of those kids, they come from like the same type of background as myself, where everything isn't like on a, just not handed to them. Or some of those kids even had a bad break. Some of those kids didn't have like their mother or father involved. I was lucky to at least have my mom involved, right? So even when they have those bad days at school, and sometimes they'll tell you, well, I was just missing my mom. And they acted out at school. So, yeah. You know, you just always, I'm always processing when I'm on, just there's a better way of doing this. And there's a way that if you bring it to me, I'll, you know, speak with your worker and we'll get you connected with your family, right? And so the one thing, like I, you know, constantly preach to them is that, hey, life isn't fair. It's not going to be fair, but we just got to make the most of it, right? Your life here at this home, they can only be with us until they're 18 years of age. And then, you know, they're going to, you know, progress to an adult living home, or they're going to relocate back with family.
Mook, man, I love your story. Awesome. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. I hope everything's great. We'll see you soon.
Okay, buddy. Anytime.